When I read over the Bible passage the lectionary suggests for study, two questions usually come to mind. First, what's this story all about? Is it history? Is it poetry? Is it a metaphor? Just exactly what was the author of this thing trying to say? And second, considering that a couple of thousand years have passed since the author wrote the story, why would anybody in the world today care about what that writer was trying to say? Those are the two questions that are the catalyst for almost every sermon delivered around the world on a Sunday morning. What's the passage about, and why should we care? There's a third question, however, that most of us who study the Bible ask of each passage, but which seldom results in anything that winds up in the sermon. And that question deals with the history of the text. Not the history in the text, but the history of the text itself. How was this Bible passage originally written, and how has it been tampered with? Redacted is the word used by Bible scholars between then and now. This is the type of thing that interests Bible scholars and academics, but which admittedly tends to be sleep-inducing to most people. Today, the lectionary gives us a passage from the Gospel of John in which I find the history of the text so interesting I simply have to share it with you. I recognize this can be a little tedious, but in this case, I hope you'll think it was worth it. The passage is from the last chapter of John's Gospel, and it deals with a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to the disciples, and an interesting conversation between the recently crucified Jesus and Peter. To see why the history of the text is so important, we have to go to the previous chapter, the 20th, or next to last chapter of John, and consider how that chapter ends. In the 20th chapter, the women discover the empty tomb of Jesus. Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene, and then Jesus appears to his disciples. And then the Gospel of John seems to end as the 20th chapter ends with these two sentences. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you may have life in his name. Then chapter 21, after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples. What's wrong with this picture? The Gospel of John clearly ended with that two-sentence recap at the end of chapter 20, and then it just starts up again, and Jesus appears to his disciples all over again. What's going on here? Well, what's going on is one of the most interesting questions in modern Bible scholarship, and I hope you'll bear with my love of the academic side of the ministry long enough for me to explain the most likely explanation for this puzzle. By now, you all know that John's Gospel is different from the other three. So different, it provides a radically different picture of Jesus than do Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It is almost universally accepted that John's Gospel was the last of the four Gospels to be written, probably sometime around 90 AD, or about 60 years after the death of Jesus. Further, most scholars believe that the community which produced the Gospel of John was cut off, separated from the rest of the church, in part because they were isolated from other Christian communities. They developed different traditions and told different stories about the faith. The tradition is that of the 12 apostles, the gospel community that developed around the youngest disciple, known as John, the son of Zebedee, was responsible for this gospel. While there's no firm evidence, many scholars speculate that this Christian community took root in Ephesus, which would be in modern-day Turkey. Again, the tradition is that John taught his community about Jesus, and John's followers, perhaps with some help from John himself, eventually put the story in writing. And then John died. Now, since we are playing Bible sleuths here and trying to solve a mystery, to understand what happened next, we have to read a part of this passage, the 21st chapter, which has been added to that original gospel. Now, follow this because I know it's a little confusing. And remember, this is supposedly John recalling an incident that he himself witnessed. The author who tacked on this passage has Jesus talking with Peter, and Jesus, while talking to Peter, points to John and says, "If it is my will that he remain until I come again, what is that to you?" In other words, Jesus says to Peter, "If I want John to still be alive at my second coming, that's none of your business, Peter." And if you're thinking that doesn't make much sense, you're right. But stick with me a moment longer, because it appears that that little line spoken by Jesus is the whole reason somebody added this chapter to the original gospel. Evidently, it was widely believed that Jesus had told his disciples that the apostle John would still be alive to see the second coming. And here was John's gospel, which this community of Christians that had developed around the apostle John wanted the entire church to accept as the true story of Jesus Christ. And John died, and still no second coming of Jesus. So, according to those Bible scholars who think they have solved the mystery of this strangely tacked-on addition to the original gospel, the people of John's community, after John had died, revised the original story to include a 21st chapter, a chapter that clearly has Jesus saying it might be his will to return while John is still alive, but clearly not saying that John would definitely be alive when he returns. The entire final chapter of the Gospel of John, it appears, was written after the fact to dispel the false legend that the Apostle John would live to see the second coming. Well, enough of the history of the text. These are the types of things that keep some of us excitedly awake at night and lead others to think we should get alive. Moving on to the more standard sermon fodder, the story itself, I'm personally glad that late first century redactor decided to tack an extra chapter onto John's gospel. Had he not seen fit to tinker with the original, we wouldn't have that wonderful conversation between Jesus and Peter that we heard read from the lectern this morning. Three times Jesus asks Peter if he loves him. Three times Peter responds that he does. And three times Jesus says about the same thing. Then, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. When we hear this passage, we can't help but thinking of a couple of other famous passages from John's gospel. The 10th chapter of John contains the story of the Good Shepherd, in which Jesus claims to be the gate for the sheep, the doorway through which one may pass to arrive in the presence of God. And we're told that the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep, as opposed to the hired man who abandons the sheep and runs away. And the other story that comes to mind is Peter standing nearby as Jesus is condemned to death and fulfilling the prediction of Jesus by three times denying that he even knows him. When we read the 21st chapter of John, we discover that the disciples have returned to their fishing boats, reminiscent of the story of the miraculous catch of fish in the other Gospels. Jesus appears to the disciples at the conclusion of an unsuccessful fishing trip, and again their nets are soon overflowing with fish. But this time the focus is changed. When Jesus repeatedly asks Peter if he loves him, he seems to be saying, "If you love me, why are you out here fishing? There's work to be done, and it doesn't involve catching fish. Remember, I told you long ago I would make you a fisher of people, a gatherer of my flock. If you love me, tend my sheep. If you love me, feed my lambs." By the time this story of the conversation between Jesus and Peter was written, the tradition that Peter was the leader of the early church, was firmly established. Peter had been given the keys to the kingdom. Peter was the rock upon which the church would be built. Remember, Peter's the guy standing there at the pearly gates. So Peter, in this story, represents the church as a whole. Peter represents us, you and me. And that's why this story remains meaningful, even though it was not a part of the original gospel, and even though it has been almost 2,000 years since it was first written. Since Peter represents us, the church, Jesus poses a tough question when he asks us, "Do you love me?" What does that mean? After some serious reflection, I've come to the conclusion that it has something to do with bumper stickers. As most of you know by now, I love bumper stickers. If you ever hear that I've been in a car accident, you can probably assume I caused the wreck by trying to read the fine print on some bumper sticker while sailing across Kellogg in rush hour traffic. This is slightly off the subject, but the most interesting one I've seen recently was on the back of a pickup truck. I don't know why, but pickups seem to have more than their fair share of good bumper stickers. And this one only had three words on it, but they were doozies. "Darwin loves you." Well, that is certainly food for thought. But getting back to the subject at hand, I see bumper stickers every now and then that say, "I heart Jesus. I love Jesus." Sometimes I wish I could flag those people over to the side of the road and say, "How do you do that? You know, what do you mean by that? You say you love a person who physically left the world a couple of thousand years ago. What does it mean? What do you mean when you say you love Jesus?" And I fear the answer might be, "Well, it means I go to church and put religious bumper stickers on my car." I have a feeling there's a little more to it than that. Because to love Jesus means we have to love what Jesus represents. We have to love certain ideas, certain ways of thinking. We have to embrace a special way of being in the world and living our lives if we're going to proclaim a love of Jesus. So what does Jesus represent? To me, it seems that Jesus represents all that is good and right. Jesus was the earthly embodiment of goodness, of love, of unselfish caring. And I think people are basically good. I know I've been accused more than once of finding God's love and goodness at places and times where most people find them absent. But I can't help myself. I can find something good in every second that God calls creation into being out of that quantum soup from which it springs forth. And I think that it is in our basic nature to love Jesus, to love what is good and what is right. Still, at least according to this story from the Gospel of John, there's a simple litmus test to see if our love is real or if it extends only to the depths of our vocal cords. And that test is found in the three words of Jesus, "Feed my sheep." Okay, what does that mean? Is this feeding of the sheep spiritual or physical? And who are the sheep? Are the sheep the people of a congregation? The people of the worldwide church? Or all the people of the world? Isn't the Bible amazing? There are so many stories like this that can just stop us in our tracks and make us think harder and deeper than we would normally prefer. I believe the feeding that Jesus is talking about is both physical and spiritual. I think feeding the sheep involves both the spiritual nurture of fellow Christians and the actual giving of food, material sustenance to those in need. And I believe the sheep include the local congregation, the worldwide church, and all the people in the world. I consider myself extremely fortunate to have lived in the real world before I entered the ministry. The men and women I know who went to seminary right out of college without ever having to scratch for a living in fields other than the ministry tend to have a skewed vision of life in the world. It's so easy for a person to stand in the pulpit and berate people for not spending all their free time acting like Mother Teresa. I know that when I had a real job, that's how Lee laughingly refers to my change of vocation. When I had a real job, I'd come home from work. I was pretty much done for the day. I cherished the time I had to spend with my family, and most evenings I could do an excellent imitation of a couch potato. And there was nothing wrong with that. I'd earned that downtime. Nobody is more aware than I am that if everybody quit their jobs and went to seminary, we could all stand around and minister to each other while the world falls apart at the seams. What I'm saying is, people can follow the advice of Jesus and feed his sheep without leaving their everyday lives behind. Unlike Peter, whose job it was to start the church, it's our job to be a part of the church. As one of my seminary professors always said to first-year students who arrived on campus full of the Spirit and ready to take on all the problems of the world, "Do you want to save the world? Well, I'm sorry, but that job has already been taken." When I say that this story is Jesus' way of telling us to spiritually nurture and physically feed the people of our congregation, the people of the worldwide church, and the people of the world, I believe that we, the people of University Congregational Church, are doing that. I'm proud of the way the people of this congregation conduct themselves, and I would like to give three brief examples of all three cases. First, we have feed my sheep, meaning take care of the people of your congregation. Let's face it, we're a fortunate group. We don't have people showing up hungry here on Sunday morning. So in this case, we nurture the people of our congregation spiritually. This is nowhere more evident than when a member of this congregation dies. The people of this church reach out with love and tenderness, and their offers of assistance in whatever ways possible are heartfelt and sincere. The women of the guild arrange a reception in fellowship hall following the memorial service so comfort and support can be given and healing begin. Our common spiritual nurture begins right here on Sunday mornings when we worship together and embrace our common vision of the faith, a vision based on the right of every individual to conceive of God in his or her own way and to support those whose spiritual journeys parallel our own. Everything we do in this place, really, from the children's Christmas program to Cook's Night Out, is a part of our fulfillment of Jesus' command, feed my sheep. Second, there is feed my sheep, meaning take care of the worldwide church. And this is important. For all its faults, there can be no argument that the single group doing the most good in the world today is the church. Those 2 billion of us that call ourselves Christian feed more people and ease more suffering than any other group in the world. Over the 2 decades this church has been in existence, it's handled itself perfectly, I believe, because our focus has been quite naturally on ourselves. The people of this congregation have struggled and sacrificed to make this place a reality, and that's why it is a strong and vibrant institution today. And we are just now in a position to begin concerning ourselves with the wider church. Whatever the outcome of today's vote, I hope we all agree that it is time to commit ourselves as a congregation to finding ways to support the church throughout the world as it seeks to transform this world into the kingdom of God. We can't all be Mother Teresa's, but we can recognize that there are Mother Teresa's out there and seek ways to support them. And third, there is feed my sheep, meaning take care of the people of the world. On this count, I will only say the people of University Congregational Church do more and posture less than any congregation I've ever seen. All that good work, and at the same time, my guess is we have fewer religious bumper stickers per capita than any church in town. And that goes to the heart of things. From the outreach funds, which have helped everybody from the hungry homeless in Wichita to the earthquake victims in India to the tornado victims in Hoisington, and from private donations to almost every worthwhile cause imaginable, it is my greatest joy in life to see the people of this congregation respond to Jesus' command, feed my sheep. May we always remain committed to letting our love unfold, not in words and not in pious sentimentality, but in concrete action. In a few moments, we will vote regarding our possible affiliation with the United Church of Christ. I believe this issue has been discussed thoroughly, and I believe everybody is in a position to make an informed vote. The vote will be by private ballot, and I hope all members of this church will remain in their seats so they can cast their votes. I want you to know that I fully respect the right of each of you to vote your conscience, and I understand that even people who love one another can prayerfully disagree at times. My promise to you is that after this vote, and regardless of its outcome, this congregation will come together and will remain united, standing on the principles upon which it was founded, congregational autonomy and Christian love.